This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Do you think Australia needs to ban porn that depicts strangulation, choking, suffocation? Because the death of a 16-year-old girl in Sydney recently has started these conversations. It's got politicians talking about a possible ban and why strangulation is becoming more common in sex between young people. So what do you think? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to get into this conversation that the government reportedly is considering a ban on strangulation porn. We're also going to have a chat with consent advocate Chanel Contos.
There is such a widespread normalisation of sexual violence in young people.
Yeah, we're going to speak with Chanel about her campaign to make algorithms optional, give you the chance to fix your feed. We'll hear how all of that is going. First, though, a verdict in one of the most high-profile murder trials in music history.
This is Hack.
Breaking news just in from the United States.
It has been nearly 30 years since Tupac Shakur was gunned down.
The man accused of orchestrating his killing has finally been found guilty.
Ladies and gentlemen, we do have a verdict. Please rise for the jury.
On Triple J.
Yeah, the killing of legendary hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur in 1996 is a story that has inspired rumour, speculation, conspiracy theories, and music for decades. One of the world's biggest rappers, 25 years old, shot four times in Las Vegas. So who did it? Who organised it? Well, today, a guilty verdict 30 years later. A former gang boss, Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, the first conviction in this cold case. A jury finding him guilty of one count of murder with a deadly weapon. So what played out? Well, let's speak to someone who was actually in court for this historic verdict. Anushka Mutanda-Dawadi is a BBC presenter and joins us now from Las Vegas. Anushka, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
The murder of Tupac Shakur in 1996, obviously one of the most high-profile cold cases in history. Can you remind us, like, what happened here?
So for a long time, everybody's had different theories about what happened on the 7th of September 1996. Today, the jury found that the prosecution's theory was correct, which is that on this night in Las Vegas, there was a fight. There was a Mike Tyson fight taking place at the MGM Grand. At the MGM, a guy called Orlando Anderson, who was 20 years old, was beaten up by Tupac Shakur, Suge Knight, and a bunch of other guys in their entourage. Now, he's the nephew of the defendant, Dwayne Keefe D. Davis. Dwayne Keefe D. Davis is, according to the prosecution, a shot caller, a high-up member of the gang, the Southside Compton Crips, as about as high up as you can get. He finds out that his nephew was beaten up really badly, and he says, right, we need retribution and we need revenge. They get into a white Cadillac and they are driving around Las Vegas looking for Tupac Shakur and Suge Knight. And Dwayne Keefe D. Davis has a gun. And when they pull up next to Tupac and Suge Knight, he instructs shots to be fired into that car. Now, we did hear him throughout the trial on different recorded interviews that he'd given to law enforcement repeatedly say, you know, if they were on the right side of the car for me, I would have shot them myself. But he was sat on the wrong side of the car. And it's actually his nephew, Orlando Anderson, who delivers the killing shot.
Okay, so Dwayne Davis, also known as Keefe D, is not the person who pulled the trigger, but is guilty of orchestrating this murder, according to the court. I mean, Anushka, what was some of the more wild evidence you heard during this trial?
Oh, geez. I mean, I don't know if anybody's ever going to stop talking about Mob James. I mean, the part of the thing that makes this trial so unique is we're talking about people who were gangsters 30 years ago. They're not gangsters anymore. They're 61, 63 years old. They want to look after their grandkids. They got three teeth and they don't want to be in the courtroom. So Mob James was in the opposing gang to the Southside Compton Crips. He was their blood. There was a rivalry between those two gangs. He did not want to be in court and he did not want to be testifying against Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, even though there was a rivalry there, because the undercurrent of gang culture is that you do not talk to the police. However, through Mob James trying his absolute hardest to be a hostile witness and not snitch on anybody, this man managed to snitch on everybody and their mum. He literally got on that stand and basically testified to the fact, saying, as soon as that trigger was pulled, within 2 minutes, everybody knew who did it. They knew it was Keefe D, they knew it was Orlando Anderson, they knew in Las Vegas, and they knew in Compton. But the way that testimony came out was him kicking and screaming and saying, I don't want to snitch, I don't want to snitch, and then ended up being one of the most damning witnesses for the defense, in so much so that he, clips of what he said was replayed today as part of the prosecution's closing argument to say, hey, if you don't believe us, listen to what Mob James had to say, which was basically everybody with eyes could see it was Keefe D who was responsible.
And Keefe D, this man convicted, he had talked about his role in the killing before quite openly, right?
Yeah, he wouldn't shut up. That's the problem. I mean, originally he spoke to the police specifically about what happened in Vegas in 2008 as part of what's called a proffer agreement, which is where they said they actually had a drug trafficking case against him that could have landed him in jail for the rest of his life. And they said, if you talk to us about what happened and you give us honest information, we'll drop the drug trafficking case and we won't use your words against you. We won't prosecute you using your own words. So he spoke in 2008 and 2009. Then he started doing podcasts and BET documentaries. In 2017, he does a 6-part documentary for BET. And then in 2019, he writes his memoir, Compton Street Legend, where he tells this story of exactly what I've said. That happened in Vegas, that he supplied the gun, that he was in the car. Now, Keefe D says, I didn't write the book. It was written by somebody else. And I lied in the book. I fabricated things to sell copies. That's not what that jury found today. They found that he, as the prosecution termed it, his private admissions mirror his public admissions. So basically, he's privately and publicly said that he was responsible for this.
Extraordinary case when the defense team is arguing that their client has lied in the past. I mean, what happened in court when the guilty verdict came down, Anushka?
Well, there was actually a markedly barely any reaction from Keefe D. He's pretty stony-faced most of the time. And there was very little reaction from his family, which was juxtapositioned with what was going on the other side of the room, which was a huge reaction from Tupac Shakur's family. They were extremely emotional. They were holding hands, hugging. After the verdict was read out, they were hugging the prosecutorial team, hugging Giacomo, so lead prosecutor. And I think it just brought it home for a lot of people who might have been wondering, why are we doing this 30 years later? You know, they lost their 25-year-old brother. They lost basically a baby. Like, we think of Tupac as like a full-grown adult, but he was very, very young. And have been left with unanswered questions and conspiracy theories and speculation on a global scale for 30 years. And I think you just saw today the outpouring of emotion that was just like, finally, there is an answer and there is some semblance of justice here.
All right, this is Hakam, Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with BBC presenter Anushka Motunda-Dawadi, who was in court in Las Vegas for the verdict in the Tupac murder trial. A former gang boss, Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, today being found guilty of murder. Anushka, how significant do you think this moment is for music history?
I mean, it's massively significant. It was one of the great tragedies that both Tupac Shakur and, of course, Biggie Smalls, who were beefing, but originally friends, but then beefing, had lost their lives so young. Tupac Shakur was not just a hip-hop artist. He was a socially conscious rapper. He was more like a political figure. What he was speaking about in his work, social mobility within the African-American community, the position of African-American women, what it looked like, you know, economic freedom within the Black community in America. These were such poignant issues. They're poignant issues now, poignant issues at the time. Police brutality, this is set against a backdrop of racial unrest. And this 25-year-old is talking about all these things in his music and was a leader within the community. It was a great injustice that his life was taken in that way and that it has remained sort of this unsolved mystery that's been poured over and turned into documentaries and made the subject of so many different pieces of public speculation. What does it mean for music culture? You know, it's a big unsolved case in rap history, but I think it's even bigger for, you know, Black culture, African-American culture, American history, that this finally kind of has some semblance of closure for such an impactful political figure.
And just finally, what happens now? Will Dwayne Davis appeal? How much time is he facing in jail?
Yeah, so he could be looking at the rest of his life behind bars. You got to remember he's 63 years old. He's already been in there for 3 years without bail. He did indicate that he wants to appeal. He actually, it was the only time he spoke up today. He said he wanted all his computers and iPads back, which was felt like a strange thing to ask for, given that he just received a conviction, and then said, I want to appeal. And the judge let him know, you know, that's something that happens at sentencing. So he's got a long way to go, but this isn't the end of Dwayne Davis's legal journey, shall we say.
Look, a massive day for you in Las Vegas. BBC presenter Anushka Matanda-Dawadi, really appreciate you joining us on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Hack.
When we think about drinking alcohol during pregnancy, we sort of have landed on there's no safe level of drinking. And I think that's sort of the right message we need to have around strangulation.
On Triple J.
Does Australia need to ban depictions of strangulation in porn? Because some politicians, including government MPs, are saying we need to be looking at this after the death of a 16-year-old Sydney girl last week. Advocates are saying depictions of strangulation in porn normalise what is a really dangerous thing. But I'm keen to hear what you think. Message in 0439757555. Already getting some messages through. Someone saying it's a shame it's taken such a tragedy to start a conversation that we should have been having years ago. But someone else, Angie and Mianjin, saying, look, I think consensual and pre-discussed strangulation with someone trusted can be arousing, and I think we should leave Australian porn alone. Ariana Lucente's been looking into this.
There is no safe way to strangle someone.
There are calls to ban strangulation and suffocation in porn in Australia. And Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek reckons it's worth considering.
I think it's something that we should be looking at very seriously. We've seen the tragic reported incidents recently here in Sydney. Like, it is absolutely heartbreaking.
Paramedics were called to a 16-year-old girl's residence following reports of asphyxiation followed by seizures.
Recently, a 16-year-old girl in Sydney was believed to have lost consciousness after a suspected strangulation during consensual sex. She was airlifted to hospital in a critical condition. But 2 days later, she died.
Police have since launched an investigation into the circumstances surrounding her death. At this stage, they are aware of the other parties involved but have not laid any charges.
I think this rocked everyone to their core.
The death of this 16-year-old girl has brought national attention to what young people are seeing in porn. New South Wales opposition leader Kelly Sloan wants the federal government to introduce an urgent ban on depictions of strangulation and suffocation in porn.
It has the ability to program the young, vulnerable minds of a generation of people whose first sexual experiences are being distorted because of this. Kids at 16, this is shocking, and it's becoming normalised, and that should worry us all.
In the UK, it's now illegal to create or share porn featuring strangulation or suffocation.
Pornography is not real life. This is not sex education.
So how common is strangulation in sex, really?
I do think it's something that is more common in younger people's lives than in older people's lives.
Professor Heather Douglas is from Melbourne Uni's Law School and the Centre of Excellence for the Elimination of Violence Against Women.
We did a survey with just under 5,000 young people aged 18 to 35. About 50% of them said they were engaging in strangulation during sex, either strangling another person or being strangled by their partner.
She says more than 60% of them learnt of it via porn and 40% from social media. And she says the risks in strangulation are high.
Basically, it only takes the pressure of opening a can of drink to cause unconsciousness and death, so not much pressure is required. We know that death can occur within 1 to 3 minutes. We know that unconsciousness can occur within 10 to 15 seconds.
Some injuries can be lifelong.
The obvious ones like bruising and so on, but also ringing in the ears, changes to voice. Some people will get blood clots from strangulation.
And brain injuries might be harder to clock.
So women who have experienced strangulation, there are changes to the structure of the brain. There are also losses of problem-solving capacity and loss of memory. So it doesn't take much to have those effects on people.
You only need 5 episodes of injury to the brain and you get a permanent injury. There's no healthy way to stop oxygen to your brain. It's not good.
Danielle Crozier is the CEO of Women's Health New South Wales.
We're up to 123% increase in women presenting with concerns about the brain injuries they might have.
She says young people tend to call it sexual choking, but technically choking is more like choking on a piece of food, whereas strangulation refers to external pressure on the neck.
Strangulation has always been part of the violence sector, domestic violence or sexual assault, but the sexual choking is an entire new genre. We still don't do enough work on contraception, let alone how to have good sex, but how not to have dangerous sex.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente reporting there. And look, there are a lot of thoughts coming through on the text line right now. Hack audience has big thoughts on whether strangulation porn should be banned in Australia. Someone says, can they ban rape porn and other abuse in porn while they're at it? Why do people get off on abusing others? Someone else, yes, we definitely need to ban strangulation porn. But someone else saying, we've only just put age limits on porn websites. Shouldn't we see how effective they are or aren't? Another person, strangulation should be banned. It can be done safely, but porn videos do not show the conversations that happen beforehand in the BDSM community, for example. But someone else, yeah, men and boys will say all is fine. It's not fine. Porn is getting more violent and the manosphere has a lot to answer for. Well, let's talk about that now. Talk about algorithms, the impact of the manosphere with someone who is discussing this a lot, especially this week.
Hack. I miss the time when social media was first created. The feed wasn't endless.
On Triple J.
Because Chanel Kontos is getting ready to give a big address in Canberra. Now, you'll remember Chanel as a consent advocate who started the charity Teachers Consent. She got consent education in the school curriculum, partnered with music festivals around the world, dating apps. Last time we spoke with Chanel, she'd launched her Fix Our Feeds campaign, advocating for optional algorithms. The chance for you to say no to being fed stuff that you don't want to see on social media. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about consent education more broadly, misogynistic views in young Australians. Chanel Kontos, welcome to Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Firstly, how is the campaign doing? Because I know last time we spoke, you had a lot of people on board. You had celebrities, you had former prime ministers who'd thrown their support behind Fix Our Feeds. Has there been much momentum?
Yeah, I think at Teachers Consent, we're a sexual violence prevention organisation and we started Fix Our Feeds because we were concerned with the sudden rise in misogynistic attitudes in young boys and men that were playing out as real-world behaviours. And we believe that these were coming from the algorithm, this machine that kind of propagates this content for clicks and profit. However, there's so many societal benefits to this policy proposition, which means, yeah, it's really been growing. And we also did polling very recently that came out to find that 71% of Australians support this policy proposition, which is quite a big majority.
Yeah, I know. And last time we spoke about it on Hack, the support that was coming through from our audience was huge. People were saying, I would sign up to this tomorrow. Like, we really need to be doing something. I mean, how much worse is the spread of misogyny online now than it was 5-6 years ago, do you reckon?
Oh, so much. I don't know if you can even like compare those two things, because 5-6 years ago was kind of the like beginning of algorithms. Like, you might get a few suggested pieces of content. And I feel like that's when people just started getting TikTok. Like, I downloaded TikTok in 2020. I was a little bit late to the party, and algorithms have definitely gotten more sophisticated. They learn off every movement we do, every hover, every swipe, every forward. And they're also engineered to promote content that gets engagement and outrage, and misogyny is a kind of perfect mix of those things.
Yeah, I was going to ask why young men might be finding this kind of content appealing. Like, what's drawing them in?
Well, it's not just this content. It doesn't get served to them kind of like all at once, a bombardment. It is like systematic funnel that takes young boys and men into more extreme forms of misogyny, and usually starts very innocently with dating advice, gym workout videos, sporting tricks, like kind of anything to identify that you are a boy or man, and it will then learn that quickly and do more with it. There's actually a really interesting report that came out recently that was basically saying we shouldn't just think of the manosphere as this like online connected community of misogynistic attitudes against girls and women, but we should think of it more as kind of like a business model that's very pyramid schemey in its sense, in that these men at the top, these bad actor content creators, firstly promote an inspirational life and say, like, these are all the things that I have and you should have, and that's what makes a good man, the sports cars, the girls, the abs, the blah, blah, blah. And then they make money off grievance. They make money off saying all the reasons why you don't have these things that I supposedly have. And that's usually the fault of women or other minorities, whoever is easy to scapegoat at the time. And they get money off those clicks and by triggering those emotions of like anger and fear and feeling like something isn't fair. And then they usually sell them some sort of solution, like very tangibly, beyond the profits that they make as creators and beyond the profits that the tech companies make. It's usually like, and here's an unregulated steroid, and here is a course on like how to pick up girls, and we're selling you the solution to your problems. Which is interesting because for women this is like an age-old phenomenon, right? Like, we know that social media and capitalism work together to make girls insecure about something and then sell them a solution to it. And now we kind of see that extending to boys and men.
It's kind of interesting how complex and sophisticated this system is. Like, people might not realise. They obviously just think they're being served random content. But as you say, there's more planning behind it. And, you know, there's gateway content as well that really lands people in a lot of harm. I know you've been speaking about some research out recently from the University of Melbourne. It looked at attitudes towards women, and some of the stuff in there was really concerning. Mm. Did it surprise you?
It didn't surprise our team because we had done a consultation on Fix Our Feeds and algorithms and all of this stuff. So we kind of had like a bit of a heads up about it, I guess. And it also didn't surprise because this kind of idea came out of a policy report I did at uni, and it kind of started with me trying to look at the similarities between the pipeline into violent extremism and the pipeline into violent misogyny. And half an hour of research told me that they were so indistinguishable that I kind of like moved on and was like, okay, well, I'll write about a solution to it then. Mm. So we know that men who hurt people will usually hurt women first. And it is interesting. We know that extremist groups recruit off misogynistic platforms and spaces, like areas of the internet, because they know that these men are pre-primed and predisposed to a kind of like us v them and like an othering, which is really devastating. Like, misogyny is a national security issue, and to think anything less, I guess, at this point would be ignorant given the research that's arisen.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Chanel Kontos from Teachers Consent, and we're talking about her Fix Our Feeds campaign, which would give you the option to turn off your algorithm. I'm keen to hear what you think about that. Do you think it's a good idea? Would you sign up to something like that if it was available? Chanel, what about the argument that regulating algorithms amounts to censorship? What do you say to that?
It's such a good point, and it's also why I try to catch myself every time I say regulating social media algorithms, because we're actually not trying to do that, because this policy proposition is crucially content neutral. We're not trying to decide what constitutes harm, what doesn't, because it's too messy of a conversation, and we are big supporters of free speech. And actually, the algorithm as it stands now impedes on freedom of access to information because it promotes and because it censors and it chooses. And the best thing about this is it's about individual choice. So you can choose whether you want your algorithm on or off. Also, the best thing about this policy is that even if you yourself think, like, you know, my algorithm's fine, I'm really happy with it, it gives me the exact baking videos that I wanted to do on the weekend, like, great, you can still support the policy because you can understand how it could help someone else. And that option is just there. It's an option.
I just want to ask you about one other thing, Chanel. I mean, there have been several cases around allegations of sexual assault involving teenagers that have been making headlines recently. Like, how concerned are you seeing this stuff?
I'm so concerned. It's so devastating. But we also know that this happens a thousandfold what gets reported in the media and what we hear about. And, you know, it's often the most kind of like extreme cases of the kind that get reported and get spoken about, but there is such a widespread normalization of sexual violence in young people. And we know that teenage boys have now overtaken adult men as the main perpetrators of violence against under 18-year-olds. And that should be taken very seriously and been seen as an opportunity to intervene at widespread scale of sexual violence.
Do you feel like it is being taken seriously? As someone who is having a lot of conversations with leaders and people in positions of power, do you think that there is really a push there to do something about this, to address it?
To be honest, I think that there is an appetite, and I think we just need to keep up public pressure, because usually implementing these solutions comes at the cost of pushing into other things. For example, the algorithm Fix Our Feeds campaign, that would directly affect big tech's profits, which means that there's like a very significant lobby who wouldn't want this to happen and who has a lot of lawyers and government power and influence and say in those sorts of consultations. And we also have a serious problem in Australia with regulatory capture, and often tech companies are used to consult of like if the technology is feasible and things like that. And that's quite ridiculous that they're kind of making their own rules about themselves. So I do think we need to keep public demand up to turn that appetite into actual commitment.
Well, look, thank you very much for coming in and having a chat with us. Always appreciate your time. Chanel Contos from Teachers Consent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And if you want to sign our open letter to the Prime Minister to ask for this Fix Our Feeds policy, our website's teachersconsent.com/fixourfeeds, or if you just go to teachersconsent.com, you'll find it very quickly.
Hack.
Went to the reunion. Great experience. A humbling one at that. Do you know how confronting it is where last time you saw someone they couldn't read and now they're much wealthier than you?
On Triple J.
How do you feel about high school reunions? Or do you have any interest in getting together with people you went to school with, seeing how their lives turned out 5-10 years on? And do reunions hit the same now you can just keep track of everyone on social media? I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this. If you're maybe nervous about your first high school reunion or you have no intention of going, tell me why. Because Jackson Worthington's been looking into it.
It's so funny though, looking back at all the like embarrassing phases.
The little moment. Look how thick my eyeliner is.
I'm at a pub in the Perth Hills and there's a group of people gathered around a wall full of old digital photos.
I had an eyeliner phase here as well.
Oh no, I actually can't.
And I had a...
I've crashed Kalamunda High School's 10-year reunion. Everyone here graduated in 2016.
There was always the joke over the last few years that, oh, Amberly, are you going to organise the high school reunion? I'm like, yeah, of course I will.
Amberly was the head girl at Kalamunda 10 years ago. She took charge of planning this reunion with help from the student council.
It's been so funny. I think we all keep saying that it hasn't been 10 years. It doesn't feel like 10 years have passed.
I caught up with Amberly and Sophia just as the reunion was kicking off.
I definitely think there are some nerves. We were even saying in the car that, you know, what would we say? How would we interact? But we've got over 90 people registered to be here tonight. So I think that really speaks to, even though it might be nerve-wracking, people are craving or wanting that opportunity to connect again, which is quite special.
This reunion only started 20 minutes ago and already the pub is full. I can see little groups forming as everyone catches up with their old classmates.
I wasn't sure if I was going to come or not, but I thought, nah, get out of the home for once.
Bryce was pretty nervous about tonight. He reckons he's changed a lot since he graduated.
In high school, I was pretty much a go around, talk to everyone kind of person, but after high school, I kind of just got anxious and just working home is all I do now. Realising, you know, 10 years have flown by so quickly is kind of crazy.
I'm here tonight to find out what a school reunion is like in your 20s. What happens at a reunion when no one shows up?
Only about 10 people of about 160 people showed up to the reunion.
Chloe Taylor is the director of Reunion, a short documentary about her 10-year reunion currently being shown at film festivals.
My thesis going in is that I think there must be maybe a reluctance to attending a reunion, and part of that could be the fact that maybe updates from your past classmates pop up almost against your will when you log into Facebook every now and then.
Chloe reached out to everyone who didn't show up to her reunion to ask why.
That included things like peer pressure from friends, not feeling ready, anxiety around being questioned about their accomplishments, whether they would be seen as enough, awkward past dynamics with former schoolmates and whether those would still exist.
After making the doco, Chloe has a couple of theories about why some people avoid reunions.
It's not just about the external world of how you're perceived by your ex-classmates, but it's also kind of draws into focus your perception of yourself, your perception of your teenage self, and how you feel about that.
Back here in the Perth Hills, and there's Kalamunda graduates all around the pub. So I've been asking people what impact they think social media has had on the idea of reunions too.
Social media, you're still connected to people and you can see the lives that they're leading since high school, but you don't necessarily have that in-person connection. And not everything on social media anymore is genuine. Like, you're seeing the best of people's lives.
I've kept in touch with a lot of the people that I wanted to keep in touch with out of high school that I was very close to. And so it's a lot more exciting to see what other people have been up to rather than just seeing what they're posting on social media.
That last voice you heard is Bailey. He was head boy at Kalamunda in 2016 and was part of the organising committee for tonight too. I chatted to him right before I left the pub. He was checking out old photos with his partner Brie.
In the middle there.
Oh, that's Emily. Yeah, who's that?
That's Caitlin.
It's really lovely, to be honest. I've seen already so many faces that I hadn't recognised. I would like to think that I've changed a lot, but ultimately I don't think so at all.
Hack on Triple J.
Jackson Worthington reporting there and hearing from a few of you on the text line, someone saying, look, that's why I joined social media in the first place, so I could keep in touch with old classmates instead of having to deal with the anxiety of attending a reunion in person. Another person says, I've fallen off the correspondence list for my school reunions. Not mad about it. And that is all we've got time for on Hack for now. I'll catch you next time.